Hi, everybody. Today is Tuesday, July 8th, 2025, and our friend Paul Kirkhurst is back with us. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Nima. Thank you.
I want to start with what's happening here in Brazil, BRICS Summit. And looking at the mainstream media, they're trying to somehow diminish the influence of BRICS. But when it comes to BRICS Summit, this in Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro, as you know, they were talking about, for the first time, they condemned the attacks on Russia and Iran, and they were talking about tariffs. But how did you find it so far? What's your take on BRICS?
Well, I think BRICS is an example of countries trying to gain their independence from Western domination. I think BRICS is a response to the Russian sanctions. And these sanctions, of course, spread. Venezuela has them, Iran has them. And the way the West functions today, they're still in that colonizing way of thinking, that the way they do things, everybody has to be subject to whatever the rules are that come out of the West. And so it's a way of having colonies without having colonies. And I think that BRICS is simply a world saying, well, we are going to be sovereign and we're not going to follow your rules. And so I think it's a good thing. It will produce more real diversity. Now, of course, BRICS would not be happening. Would not be happening if the dollar hadn't been weaponized. But the minute they weaponize the dollar and they weaponize the SWIFT clearing system by cutting people out from it, well, then that everyone sees that whoever's running that system is weaponized it and it's not reliable, and they could get weaponized if they don't do what Washington wants them to do. So it's sort of a response to the arrogance and the hubris of the United States. That's what BRICS is. And it will continue as long as the arrogance and hubris of Washington continues.
Paul, I remember Donald Trump was somehow, before coming to power, before coming to office in the United States, he was mentioning, why are we sanctioning Russia and Iran, during various interviews before being elected? And how is that changing in his mind? It doesn't seem before the BRICS summit, he said that I'm going to put tariffs on all these countries who are participating in BRICS. Why is that? Why he's not following the same sort of attitude that he was talking about before coming to office?
Well, he was speaking as a private person. And when he gets into the office of the president, he finds out that there are a lot of powerful people who he can't ignore. And they don't let him do what he said he would do as a private citizen. You know, the American foreign policy, it's hegemonic. And in a way, it always has been. You know, it goes back to the Monroe Doctrine. We told the Europeans, you can't come into South America. We've had wars with people, with Mexico, with Spain, Korea. You know, it's just sort of a, I don't know how you would call it, but it's a very arrogant kind of foreign policy. and has been. And there used to be conservatives who thought that America shouldn't have any foreign entanglements, and that they should just simply tend to their own garden and leave the rest of the world alone. And some of our most famous presidents would say that we are not a country that should have foreign entanglements or foreign allies and enemies or anything like that. Well, all those people have disappeared, and now you have conservatives who are convinced that we have enemies everywhere and we have to get these enemies. And for reasons that are really not clear, Russia's an enemy. Why? China's an enemy. Why? Iran is an enemy. Why? They're not bothering us, but we're bothering them. So you've had so much propaganda. A lot of it comes from war propaganda, but the hegemonic policy of the United States today is different because it originated with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And the Zionist neoconservatives, almost all of the American neoconservatives are Jews. They're Zionist Jews. And they saw an opportunity to, with the demise of the Soviet Union, for American hegemony, which they intended to use to clear out the Arabs that were in the way of Israel's expansion, in the way of Greater Israel. And, you know, they had their programs, the documents, 7 countries in 5 years, and were using the United States military and lives and money to remove Israel's opponents. And they were mainly Israel's opponents because of Israel's aggression. So this is a new form of hegemony compared to the old original kind, which was based in some sort of liberal idea of American exceptionalism. We were exceptional people because we had formed up a country based on liberty and freedom and accountable government. And we didn't come out of kings and queens and monarchs and aristocrats and emperors, and the law was the customs of the people determined the law. And of course, all of this we got from the British. But this type of exceptionalism is different from what we have now. And the neoconservatives are a very small group of people. They're not very many of them, but they have dominated foreign policy since the Soviet collapse. And they've broken all the agreements. They broke the promise that the George Herbert Walker Bush administration made to Gorbachev, to the Soviet president, that there would be no expansion of NATO as long as Russia agreed to the reunification of Germany. But all of the treaties that were made to limit nuclear arms, to build trust, to cut down the chance that there would be some kind of a nuclear confrontation, the neoconservatives have destroyed them all. They're all gone. And there hasn't been a government without them since 1991, 1992. But for them, it's not so much for American purposes as for Israel's. See, we've been in wars for almost 25 years against Arab countries for Israel. Well, these Arab countries did nothing to us. Nothing. We destroyed Libya, Iraq, Syria, Somalia. We've destroyed Lebanon. It's nothing like what it used to be. And now they're trying to get us to destroy Iran. And there'll be more. So when you manifest that type of nonsensical aggression, it's not even in our interest. We don't get anything out of it. What are we getting out of it? A bad reputation and shame. We have now, Netanyahu, this is the third time he's been to Washington in 6 months. What for? What a, it's a tiny little country of no significance. And they come over here and tell us what we have to do. We haven't had Putin here, or the leader of China, or the leader of Iran. We got this mass murderer, Netanyahu. He comes over here 3 times in 6 months. Like every 2 months, he comes over here and gives Trump his marching orders. This makes it very difficult to be proud to be an American. It's kind of shameful, really, isn't it? I mean, you know, the Romans were very careful who they met with. So were the Byzantines. And whoever they met with, they made it clear that they were giving the orders, not the visitor.
Do you think that the United States needs a second 4th of July?
Yeah, I wrote about that. In fact, that was my 4th of July column. I said, who's going to liberate us from the Israelis? It's a good question, isn't it? I mean, it's shameful, really. It makes me ashamed that we have a government that's totally under control of Israel. And we've been at war for the first quarter of the 21st century for Israel. It doesn't do us any good, does us harm. It's our people that got killed and maimed, and it's our money that got wasted. I don't even know what is the sum. I don't know. Trillions of dollars we've wasted blowing up Arab countries. You know, it's, and for what purpose? And producing millions of refugees that overrun us as well as Europe. You know, we've gotten nothing out of these wars, and they're all based on the lie of the war on terror. You know, the lie is that the Arabs blew up the World Trade Center. And so this, of course, was an inside job of the neoconservatives. It was their new Pearl Harbor. It gave them the excuse they needed to go to use us to destroy Israel's enemies. So, and nobody wants to investigate that.
Paul, go ahead if you want.
No, you go ahead.
Yeah, in this summit, in BRICS summit, we know that Indonesia is a full member of BRICS, is a new and full member of BRICS. And there, you look at the list of countries who want to join BRICS, Vietnam, Malaysia, Thailand, and these countries are huge in terms of, when we consider Indonesia, for example, or Malaysia, these are huge countries with big economies.
Yeah.
And if they join all these forces together, and as you've mentioned, it's not because they somehow woke up and said, we want to make a new institution to just be against the United States. It's all because of the tariffs, because sanctions, they were talking about tariffs in this summit. One of the main issues, the most important issue to be discussed, that was discussed in this summit, was the case of tariffs. Do you feel that somehow in the mind of those people in power in Washington, do they really feel that tariffs are different from sanctions? That's why you can use somehow them to punish the other countries? Because in my opinion, both tariffs and sanctions are the same thing. But from your point of view, what is the difference between these sort of tactics on their part? If is that's a tactic?
Well, I think I regard tariffs as a legitimate way for a country to protect an industry that otherwise would be stomped out by established industries in other countries. If you want to,
we have tariffs here, by the way, in Brazil. I know what we're talking about.
Yeah, and I think every country has had tariffs, and Trump's claim, and I don't know if it's true or not, is that other countries' tariffs on us were higher than ours on them, and he wants to force everybody to have the same low tariffs like we were charging, and his method of doing that is to threaten them with high ones. I don't know how real any of these tariffs turn out to be. They seem to be some kind of a negotiating thing. He threatens huge tariffs, and then the tariffs go away, or they make exemptions. We've talked about it. You know, a lot of the initial tariffs, they really didn't apply to anything because the list of exemptions was so long. And the exemptions were factors of production that American companies needed, so they took them off. It's kind of like the deportations. You know, he was going to deport all these people, but now we're not going to deport restaurant workers and hotel workers and the people that work in the chicken factories, the slaughterhouses, the agricultural workers who are not going to deport. So the list of people who are not going to be deported, there's hardly anybody left on the list. It appears they'll end up deporting the criminal gangs, but that's not millions of people. So what Trump's found out is that huge sectors of the American food and restaurant and hotel and entertainment industry is dependent on all these illegals. And so the companies are telling them, don't you dare take away our workforce. Don't you dare. And I think that the same thing happened with the tariffs. The company said, look, you're going to drive us into bankruptcy. We're not going to be able to get these things. And so, okay, we'll exempt it. Well, when you exempt it for the first person, you're going to have to exempt it for the next 1,000 people. So these things, I don't know. I think it's just Trump not understanding. Now, it's not so much whether it's tariffs or sanctions or what it is. It's a form of bulliness. It's bulliness. Europe and Washington have been bullies because they had the military power and the economic power. You know, the British rule the world. The sun never set on the British Empire. You know, the French had colonies, even the Germans, until they lost the war, had colonies in Africa. And the United States is just a bully. And I think that's what people are objecting to. And during the long period of the Cold War, of the so-called communist menace, when people had this fear that the Bolshevik revolution would continue to expand and take over more and more of the country, they put up with American bulliness because it was the way to protect them. It's the way they were protected. And so they felt they had to go along, incorporate into whatever Washington said. But the Soviet Union is gone. Russia is not aggressive, and China still says it's communist, but it's not. It's just totally capitalist, you know. In fact, they seem to have a smarter version of it than we do. So the people don't feel these threats. They try to keep a Russian threat alive in Europe by saying, oh, if we don't stop them in Ukraine, they'll take France and Germany and everything else. But I don't think ordinary people believe that. This is something governments are saying for reasons that are unclear. And so it's bossiness, it's bulliness. And I just don't think it works any longer. I don't think people are afraid of the bully. BRICS is a way of assertion for a country. And I don't think BRICS is going to be a political organization against the West. I don't think that's what it, I don't even think Putin thinks of it that way. It's going to be an association of countries that treat each other according to international law, according to the way things are supposed to happen. So the Americans don't behave that way. They impose their own rules over international law. And this is Putin's big objection, and I think all these other countries. So I don't think it's a political organization. It's a way of trying to look, let's go on with our business and let the West dwindle away. And I don't think it'll ever be a military alliance against the West or anything. It's just a way of being able to trade, to exchange resources, because different countries have different things, and it'll give birth to a second world. There'll be a second world. That's clearly not a third world. There'll be a second first world, and the first world will be moving backwards toward the third world. That's the way I see it. These other countries now will come to life, and they'll get along. No one wants to conquer them. Putin doesn't want to conquer them. The Chinese doesn't want to conquer them. You know, the Chinese are building their modern form of the Silk Road, which is to have commerce between all these countries. They're obviously confident, the Chinese, that they be one of the leaders of this, but it's a non-military form of leadership more than domination.
Paul, we had, I don't know if you watched the interview Tucker Carlson had with the president of Iran, Masoud Pezeshkian.
And no, I didn't get to see that.
Yeah, no. That was somehow, to me, was surprising, because while Netanyahu was meeting with Donald Trump, he published the interview with the president of Iran. And the main goal, I would say, the main message of the Iranian president was that whatever is happening between Iran and the United States is because of Israel and the way that Netanyahu is behaving. And Netanyahu is trying to do everything to just put an end to the talks, put in whatever relationship the two countries are considering. Do you think that those bases, those people who were somehow optimistic about Donald Trump, who were supporting Donald Trump for his attitude, with his sort of point of view that he had before coming to power in various interviews, as we talked, he was talking about those points. Do you think that is it going to influence those people to talk, to somehow pressure or somehow behave in a way that puts pressure on Donald Trump?
Well, I think it's going to cost him the strength of his support. People may still support him, but they just won't be so gung-ho. You know, a lot of things already have gone wrong for him. Take the Epstein, you know, this Epstein, this pedophile guy who they were going to release those files. The attorney general, Bundy, she said she's got all these files on her desk and all these videos, and she's going through it. But then the other day we had the FBI announce that there's not any files, there's no black book, there's no list of his clients. Well, how can they say that when the attorney general has already said she's got it all? So you see, they're not going to release it. The illegals aren't going to get deported. We see other things that were going to happen that are not going to happen. Robert Kennedy has had to back off on glyphosate. He was going to stop the use of glyphosate in agriculture. Well, now he had to announce that, well, the farmers are so dependent on it, we're not going to take this away from them. The same thing will probably happen with vaccines. The big pharma is just more powerful than the Secretary of Health and Human Services. just like Netanyahu seems to be more powerful than the President of the United States. You see, in none of the wars we fought in the Middle East in the 21st century were declared by Congress. The American people were never really given any reason for these wars. Something about a war on terror. Well, what the hell is a war on terror? You know, that's, and where were the terrorist acts? One terrorist act, 9/11. It turns out it's an inside job. It wasn't a terrorist act. So it's a situation where once money gets into politics, as it has in the United States and of course all of Europe now, especially Britain, then the money interests are the ones who rule and make the decisions. And we're seeing that now, even with the Trump administration, even with the people. These were supposed to be really tough, committed people, but they're already being forced to back off, back off, back off. Israel has been in charge for so long, I think it's just become natural. The military security complex has been in charge for so long. Big Pharma has run the FDA, the CDC, the NIH for so long that you can't take the power back. So it's a situation where the notion that the government is democratic, elected by the people, responsible to the people, this is not true. It's simply not true, and we're seeing that even Trump can't perform. And what do you end up with? You end up with the government is a purchased entity. It's purchased by the people, the interest groups. I mean. Who can give the most campaign contributions. And so we have purchased governments. A few years ago, a German newspaper editor wrote a book called Purchased Journalism, or Bought Journalism, in which he said the journalists were all bought by the interest groups. principally the CIA. Well, but the governments are bought by interest groups and by Israel. And it seems the Russians have the same problem. I don't know enough about the Chinese, but certainly the United States, the government at every level is purchased by those with the campaign contributions. So how you get out of that kind of fix is hard to know. If Trump really wanted to rule, he would have to have money taken out of politics. And that would require a law. And the Congress would have to pass the law that wipes out their own campaign contributions. They're not going to do that. So I think the answer to you is that a government in the United States will become weaker. It may be that the left ideological part of the Democrat Party may be the only part that is prepared to run over the interest groups. They probably wouldn't be able to do it, but they might at least attempt it. But if you don't have a very strong ideology and you're faced with powerful interest groups, you're defeated. And that's what I think we're seeing with Trump. You know, look how much time he spends now in foreign affairs, Russia, Ukraine, Iran, Israel. What in the hell is Netanyahu doing here three times in 6 months when Trump has this huge domestic agenda? And here's Netanyahu pulling him off into another war. What do we get out of it? Nothing. Nothing. And he should never have let that man come. It's just, it's humiliating, I think.
Paul, do you feel that the way that Elon Musk is talking about the third party, somehow many people are optimistic about the way that Elon Musk is talking about the third party, but how do you see the viability of having one that is capable to gain power, to gain supporters who would support it to somehow to challenge the system of two parties in the United States?
Yeah, it seems to be a difficult thing to do. You know, other people tried it. I forget the name of the first one, Ross somebody. He got 20% of the vote. And then Pat Buchanan tried it. He ran on a third party ticket. But the people are used to being a Republican or Democrat. And we have a big number of independents now. The trouble with having a third party is who finances it? Where does the money come from? Now, we can say Musk, but, you know, most of the billions that he has are tied up in productive facilities. They're not sitting in his bank account. it's in plant and equipment and stuff like that. It's not ready money at hand. So it's a very difficult thing to finance. I think a lot of thoughtful people have thought for a long time we need a third party because they don't see much difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. I think they're wrong about that because the Democrats have become very ideological. They're basically now anti-American, really. They're almost anti any kind of normality. If anybody can organize one, and maybe Musk, but it's a difficult thing. And it can't really happen until everybody who votes Republican understands that it doesn't do any good. Or it does minimal good. And, you know, they have a name for the Republicans, Republican in name only, rhinos. if people got that disgusted, possibly, but there would be such a money disadvantage, a media disadvantage. You know, the media would brand it as a white supremacist or something, you know, Nazis, who knows. It's an effort, I think, on Musk's part to revive the country. But as I described it, I don't really think the country can be revived. It's just, there's too much that's been eroded away, too many foundations collapsed. Just, it's too much gone. And the when you lose your belief system, you're finished. And from my experience in education, you know, I've been a professor in a number of universities. The main function of American universities is to destroy the belief system. That's what they do. They focus on all the failures of Western civilization and not on its successes. And they just destroyed the belief system. And the law schools have destroyed lawyers' belief in the Constitution. And the journalism schools have destroyed reporters' belief in finding the truth. It's, well, law is weaponized like the dollar. Journalism is weaponized. The function of journalism is to promote the left-wing agendas, the good agendas. And the same with law. It's to promote some kind of revolutionary social.
Paul, you mean when you talk about left-wing agenda, you're talking about the these globalists, these people are talking about?
Well, globalists or the erosion of the family, erosion of all forms of morality, sexual morality, when you get the erosion of sexual morality, you get Sodom and Gomorrah. And when you erode the cultural values, you get a Tower of Babel. You can't assimilate people who are vastly different, who come in large numbers. They don't need to assimilate. They have their own community. And so you become, you know, a country becomes a country of many nations. And all of these things, you know, all the woke stuff and the notion you're born in the wrong body and the notion you can self-declare your gender. So this is just the beginning. If you can self-declare your gender, you can self-declare your race. So there's no, everything destroys coherence. This is what I've seen in my lifetime. The coherence of everything is eroded away. And what's left is what's to defend? What's left to defend? Oh, democracy, we're going to defend democracy. What is democracy? It's the interest groups buying the government. Why you want to defend that? And most all of this happened liberal good intentions, you know. The founding fathers had it fixed up where democracy had a chance. Nobody could vote but male property owners. The Senate, the United States Senate, was not popularly elected. It was appointed by state legislators. So you had local control over your senators. Today, your senator, the senator in Minnesota, all his money may come from California. It's just too much, you know, this. All of these progressive things weaken the system. And we ended up with one that's unaccountable. The American people have nothing to say about whether we go to war or not. There's nothing. So, and nothing to say about, how we're taxed and how the money's spent. You know, we've talked about it before, Nina. Even when the parents go to school board meetings and they complain that their kids are taught they're born in the wrong body, or that they're, or that they're a racist, or, and they pr protest, and they get thrown out of the meetings. When I was a kid in school, they had what they called the PTA, the Parent Teachers Association. The parents all came to school every Thursday night and met the teachers. They went over what's being taught. The parents had just as much input into it as the school board did, if not more. In fact, the whole thing was set up to conform with the mores of the people in the community. You couldn't have possibly gone in and start teaching stuff that were so out of tune with the mores. Well, they used integration to get rid of that because they were neighborhood schools. So a neighborhood is a coherent entity. But when you started trying to get all kinds of balance of races in the schools, you had to start moving kids all across town. And they were spending hours on school buses. Well, it broke up PTA. People will go to a neighborhood meeting. They're not going to go all the way across town. So the parents basically were a casualty. See, the neighborhood schools were segregated by income class. Neighborhoods, for the most part, were not a mixture of rich, poor, and middle class. The middle class neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods, rich neighborhoods. So poor kids went to school with poor kids, middle class kids went to school with middle class kids, rich kids went to school with rich kids. In my school, there weren't any rich kids and there weren't any poor kids. So the neighborhood then had basically the same values, mores, behavior standards, the same way of behaving, the same manners. And And that would be reflected in the teachings in that neighborhood. So everyone knew that there was a difference between a middle class kid and a rich kid. And the rich kids tended to be more spoiled and not quite as responsible. And the lower class kids tend to be tougher. If we got thrown into the same congregation somewhere, we all got along because we knew there were differences and we knew what they were. But I think on the whole, everything that I've seen in my lifetime has been an erosion of falling away from the ideals and the principles and the way they used to teach and civics lessons, things worked. I don't think they have civics lessons anymore, but.
Yeah. Paul, this week, we can say last week, we've heard that Donald Trump is somehow considering not to send weapons to Ukraine and just trying to force somehow Zelensky and his administration to do something about it, to negotiate with a good faith with Russians. But here is Donald Trump at the meeting with Netanyahu talking about sending more weapons to Ukraine again. In less than 4 days, he changed his mind. Here is what he said.
More weapons to Ukraine?
We're going to send some more weapons. We have to. They have to be able to defend themselves. They're getting hit very hard now. We're going to have to send more weapons. Yeah, defensive weapons, primarily, but they're getting hit very, very hard. So many people are dying in that mess.
So if so many people are dying, why do you need to send more weapons there? So do something about it. You're not putting oil on fire.
Yeah. Well, Nima, we've talked about it before. If he wanted to stop it, he would just withdraw. He'd simply say, we've left, no more money, no more weapons, no more diplomatic. He would just leave it. I think, and of course, when he says we're not going to send weapons, he's trying to pressure Zelensky. If he says he's going to send weapons, I don't know why he's saying that now, whether Netanyahu wants to keep that war going. I don't know what Netanyahu gets out of that war. I think that here's the real problem, I think, right now. Putin wants to use the conflict in Ukraine, negotiations, to get a broad agreement. He's not interested in ending the war with negotiations. He can end it with a military victory. He's delaying a victory because he wants to end the war in a way that ends all of the antagonism in the West toward Russia. He wants, we've talked about it before, he wants a great power agreement where everything goes back to normal. No sanctions, no penalties of any kind, and no more aggressive statements. And he wants NATO off his borders. Now, this is what he means. Well, Zelensky can't deliver that. So what is the point of talking to Zelensky? He can't deliver that. Only the United States can deliver that. So why isn't Trump meeting with Putin and see if they can actually end the situation? That ending the situation, Putin has made it clear time and again, he wants to deal with the root cause of the conflict. The root cause is not Ukraine or Zelensky. So either Trump can't understand that, or he's no interest in not having the conflict. Well, because Putin is focused on trying to get a great power agreement out of this, he's neglecting everything else. Syria, Iran. If he goes to their defense, then in his head, that makes him a bigger demon for the West and less likely to get his great power agreement. So he's so focused on ending the conflict with the Western world that he's not using his capability to prevent conflict in the Middle East. The same for China. What's China doing there? They must have a huge bureaucracy focused on their new Silk Road. What do they call it? The Belt and... Do you know the phrase they use for the...
Yeah, the Belt and Road Initiative.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. They're all focused on that. Well, if they look at Iran right now, God, we can't have any conflict there. That's the road goes through there. There'll be bandits. All the trade, I mean, there'll just be bandits taking over the Silk Road. And so they're so focused on, oh, no, no conflict, no conflict, no conflict, that they don't understand that if somebody doesn't prevent Iran from being wrecked and ruined, like Libya and Syria and Iraq and all the rest, and Somalia and all the rest, there ain't going to be any Silk Road. So I think that the Chinese focus is there, and it makes them blind to the other dangers. And I think Putin's focus is on a great power agreement, and he's not willing to do anything anywhere else because it will add to the propaganda against him and make it harder to get this agreement. So once again, and nobody seems to understand this, Putin is not interested in negotiating an end of the war with Ukraine. He can win the war whenever he wants to. He's interested in ending the Cold War, the conflict. And there's no recognition of this. There's no reciprocity. Trump isn't saying, yes, we've got to end this. He's not meeting with Putin. He just says, well, Putin is unreasonable or something, or he's gone off somewhere, or, you know, he has some kind of, well, Putin's position is the solution. It's the only solution. There's not any other solution. And so if you don't go deal with it, you can't have a solution. And instead, it's just more antagonism, more antagonism. It could well be that the West hopes that Putin will win the war, because then they got more propaganda. Oh, Germany will be next. Poland will be next. You see, I think Putin knows that. That's the situation. It's not important what Trump says from one minute to the next, because whatever he's saying is meant to produce some result. If it doesn't produce a result, he'll say something else. And so I don't think we need, I mean, it makes him look maybe confused and all, but I don't think it means anything. He's just looking for some words to achieve something, because they all imply some kind of threat. And if one threat doesn't work, you look for another. So as I see it, Israel lost the 12-day war with Iran. They came out the worst. They had And they were on the verge of being completely destroyed. So Netanyahu is probably more determined than ever to use us to do an Iran. And that's why he's in Washington. And what I find highly amusing is that Netanyahu, the genocide king, writes a letter to the Nobel Committee nominating Trump, who's just bombed Iran, for the Peace Prize. I mean, this is just unbelievable. It's just... it's really unbelievable. I mean, so you can see, I mean, just in that, you see signs of just total collapse, moral collapse, manners. I mean, it goes beyond chutzpah. I mean, it's just that it's disrespectful. And so I think the two controlling factors is Putin wants a great power agreement, and the Chinese, how long have they been working on this Belt and Road thing? I mean, it's for years and years. It's a big thing. I'm sure they've got a huge bureaucracy. It's probably a very powerful element in the government. And it's probably the main focus they have. So that's where the Russian attention and the Chinese attention, that's where they are. And ours seems to be wherever Israel wants it to be.
Thank you so much, Paul, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
Thank you, Nemo. I don't know what we settled.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
It's a situation that has many perils, and things can certainly go wrong, and they don't seem to be properly appreciated. So I encourage you to keep at it. Keep at it. Keep your program going so that people can have something beyond the official narratives.
Yeah. See you soon, Paul. Take care.
So long.
Yeah. Bye-bye.